The book of Daniel in chapter 3 has a lot of negative information. There's a lot of tribulation that's spoken there. And we're all going through our own tribulations, and this country's going through tribulation. You can't turn on the TV today without seeing terrible things everywhere in the world. Our brothers and sisters are being killed and tortured in the Middle East. We have tribulation. We have difficulties. I had one of the hardest weeks of my adult life this week. A lot of things going on. And I have found that when we tell the Lord that we're going to try to clean up our life and get rid of some of the habitual sin that we have in our life, that we want to spend more time in His Word, that we want to be a better person, a better Christian, a better witness for Him, I've noticed that things get pretty hairy. And I meet with a few guys. We try to meet every week. Purpose of us getting together really is to hold each other accountable. We call ourselves the Pathetic Men's Group. And then the word pathetic refers to the fact that, you know, we've been Christians for a while, and we're pretty much sick and tired of just being mediocre. And we want to serve the Lord. And we want to do it in a greater way to glorify Him. So we get together and we just pray and we study His Word and we share and we hold each other accountable. And now it's graduated to the point where we're going to pray for the community. We're going to pray for the kids in this town and in Victor. We're so crazy that we're even talking about going to a hilltop and praying for the valley for salvation. And one of the guys just recently said, you know, we're going to start washing each other's feet. And I said, no, that's where I draw the line, okay? Nobody's touching my feet. Nobody's looking at my feet, all right? But all that aside, what happens when we get to that point is Satan starts coming after us. No question about it. And life gets difficult. I mean, I make my own difficulties, okay? So my life is tough enough with the things that I do wrong and the complications. But it's clear as a bell. It's like, you know, the right hook coming at you. You can see it coming, and Satan is so predictable. But he comes at us, and we have to be in prayer. We have to be ready for it, you know. But in everything that takes place, God tells us to rejoice. He says, rejoice in the Lord at Philippians 4:4. He says, rejoice in the Lord always. And this is so cool and so like God to do this. And it's interesting. We have to take note of it. He repeats himself. He said, I say again, rejoice. And I don't know if you've noticed it, but it's not a request. It's not, you know what, when you're feeling good and everything is going right, just be happy, rejoice in the Lord. No, it's a command. It's a command from God that we rejoice in all circumstances at all times. And how do we do that? You know, I used to read that verse, and I would say, well, it sounds good, but I just can't do it. You don't know my circumstances, Lord. You don't know what I'm going through. But he gives us the answer. The how to do this is in the why. And the why is right there, I think, the verse prior to 4:4 and then after. The two reasons. Number one, our names are written in the book of life. We have absolute certainty, those who are saved. We have absolute certainty that we're going to spend eternity in heaven together. We are with Jesus. And then the second reason is because the Lord is at hand. And that simply means that He's with us. He's in us. He's with us. No differently than He was with the boys in the furnace. He's with us here now. And He's going to be with us for eternity. So those are the two reasons we can rejoice in any circumstance, no matter what happens. The thing that I learned in studying Daniel, we often think of this book and the book of Revelation kind of, one's in the Old Testament, one's in the New Testament. Both deal with Revelation, what's going to take place in the future. We focus on the prophecies. But that's not the main thrust of either book. God knows that knowledge of future events, standing alone by itself, is a dangerous thing. If you don't have your moral compass lined up, if you don't have strong character, then it's meaningless, it's useless, or it's dangerous. So if you examine Daniel and if you examine Revelation, you will find that God spends the first, what, 3-4 chapters, maybe more, dealing with our character and our morals and how we should live in a fallen world. And how's this all relevant? If you could have the first slide, please. That's just Solomon saying that there's nothing new under the sun. Everything that's happened before is going to happen again, okay? Whatever you think you're doing today, driving around in your vehicles and flying, it's the exact same thing that was happening in life with people back when they were in buggies or in camels, okay? Now, that gives us assurance that what we're reading in the Old Testament in Daniel and all the things that God tells us in these stories is entirely applicable to today in our lives. We can rest assured that there's no divergence. What is applicable to Daniel and the boys and the king is applicable to us today. Next slide, please. This is a chart. There's a lot of them out there. You've probably seen something like this before. It's a little redundant. It's more of a secular view of what Solomon said just on a previous slide. And this is the cycle of history with most nations, the fact that they exist for about 200 years, and they go through the cycle of slavery, bondage, abundance, freedom, and then it cycles back to depravity and falling into slavery again. This is exactly what happens almost with each kingdom, country, civilization that you study in history, and it is very much on point with regard to what happened to Israel over and over again. And the reason I put it up there is it's just another example of how we can trust God's word to be applicable to our lives today. So let's review and then jump into chapter 3. Daniel and the boys have been captured and thrown into a ungodly nation, just like ours. The Babylonian kingdom and king, they don't acknowledge God, they tolerate God, just like ours. Daniel and the boys were under extreme pressure to compromise, just like we are. And the world appeared to be winning, just like it appears now. Okay. Now, reading chapter 2, which Roger finished up last Sunday, you would have thought that King Nebuchadnezzar was on his way to becoming saved. Okay, I would have. If I were the boys and I were Daniel and I had this interpretation, this mercy granted by God because of their prayers, and I went to the king and then told the king these things and the king stopped killing the magicians, and then the king honored me in the way that the king did and gave them these high-ranking jobs. Daniel was in charge of the entire country. The boys were in charge of Babylon. And the king did what he said at verse 46 through 48 of chapter 2. I'll start at 46. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face prostrate before Daniel and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. The king answered Daniel and said, "Truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret." Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and the chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. We've all had this experience. I mean, I'm having it now. You share the gospel with somebody who you think, well, I don't know, not a chance. This guy is so far gone, but he's listening. He's listening, okay? And I gave him a Bible. I even put his name on it, you know, and he's reading these tracts. And he's starting to sound like he understands what the gospel is all about. And he's talking God talk, okay? And he's listening to Christian stations. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, he's gone. He is off the charts. Not only is he off the charts and gone back to his old ways, he's worse. He's worse. And it breaks your heart, and you start to think, what more can I do? Lord, what are you doing here, okay? And I think that's probably what the boys and Daniel were feeling at this time. And in fact, in this case, the king, even though he said all these wonderful things and did these wonderful things back when the boys were like 15 or 16 years old, the king went from very bad to very, very worse, okay? The Torah says that the passage of time between chapter 2 and chapter 3 is about 15 to 18 years. So now the boys are in their 30s, and the king, he's not stupid. He's had them retain these positions for that 15 or 18 year period. He understands and recognizes their value, their abilities. You know, he's probably, they're making him money. They're keeping things, you know, organized, and they're good workers, and they're good people, and the king recognizes that, so he keeps them around. They're at his right hand, okay? They've got high office. But during that 15 or 18 year period, King Nebuchadnezzar is sitting there stewing over that dream and that interpretation. And I believe that he is very upset with what Daniel had to say. He's not happy that it's been predicted that he's going to be usurped, that he's going to lose his control over his kingdom and over the world. He's not happy at all that he's just the golden head. Not digging that at all. And I think the ticking, the clock ticking, has been going off in his mind, in his heart, for that 15 or 18 years period. And kind of like, you know, there's a contract out on him. He's thinking, okay, wait a minute. I got to keep looking over my shoulder because I don't know when that is coming. And he's probably had enough of it by the time he gets to that 15th or 18th year, and he says, you know what? I am not going to kowtow to this God of Israel. I am not going to give in to this interpretation that's 15, 18 years old. I'm going to draw the line in the sand. We think about the boys drawing the line in the sand with regard to the furnace and bowing to the idol. King Nebuchadnezzar, he drew the line in the sand first. And that's what the beginning of chapter 3 is all about. To understand King Nebuchadnezzar, we have to go back to chapter 1, verse 2. Do I have it on a slide? All right. So this is a pretty innocuous at first glance, but it's in there for a reason. It's in there in the beginning because it's God telling us what King Nebuchadnezzar's attitude was. He was very self-centered, very, very prideful, very evil, like Satan. He wanted to rule everything, and he wanted to sit on any throne, every throne, even the most high throne. So this is his attitude. This is his motivation from the get-go. He goes to Jerusalem. He knows about the temple. He knows about the artifacts. And he's not going to destroy them and burn them and trash them or turn them in and get cash. He's going to get right in God's face, take them back to Babylon, and stick them in the temples to his idols. And that's what he does. So if you understand that, then you'll understand why King Nebuchadnezzar did the things that he did all through the rest of the book before he gets saved. And I believe that the king, and as we read it, you'll see, he was a complete control freak with regard to this function that was going to take place in the desert, the Dura Desert south of Babylon. Control freak, he was dictating where it was going to be. He was dictating what the edict was going to be. He was dictating what the band would consist of. He was talking about, or he set up the statue and what it would look like. So there was no detail that was left undone that he didn't have his hands in, because it was his line in the sand. It was his plan to confront the God of Israel, all right? He couldn't involve the boys in that. He couldn't involve Daniel in that. He did it all himself. So I see this as the biggest party in Babylon, the only party in Babylon. Everybody was invited. Everybody wanted to be there. Everybody wanted to be seen there. Kind of like some, you know, gigantic Hollywood gala, all right? I think it was a very festive occasion. I think everybody was there having a good time, eating hot dogs, throwing confetti, singing songs, and just having a good old time. Probably some sincere and a lot of them insincere, like the news blurbs that we get from North Korea when the dictator died there and they showed all the people crying and wailing. And it was all because, you know, they had a gun to their head. So some of that may have been going on here. But it was in the desert, I believe, because he needed space for the crowds. Probably, you know, hundreds of thousands of folks. We know that they came from different lands, different languages. There were probably interpreters there. And then you had this gigantic band. It wasn't just a little symphony. It was more like a college, you know, marching band. The edict came down, and it was declared that everybody had to bow before this statue. When the band struck up. And I think the king knew what these three boys were going to do. And I think the Chaldeans, the magicians that ratted them out, I think they were watching too. And they knew what was going to happen. One more point. in that field with all the people and all the festivities and the band, there was a big furnace. And it was fired up, and it was loud, and it was facing everybody. Okay? So keep in mind as we go through this and we're reading through it that these three Israelis, these kids, you know, they weren't kids anymore, they went to this function with full knowledge of what it entailed. They knew what the details were. They knew what was going to be said there. They knew what the requirements were, and they went. Okay? So let's jump into chapter 3. Read along with me, starting at verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits, and its width 6 cubits. I understand that's about 90 feet tall. So almost 10 stories. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Again, because he knew he needed the space for all the crowds, the bands, and the equipment. Verse 2, and King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, everybody that was feeding at the public trough. I really like the fact that all the judges and counselors and attorneys had to go. And all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Verse 3, so the satraps and the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald cried aloud, to you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, psaltery, in symphony, with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of the burning furnace. Please note that it was an immediate execution. The rule of law that the king set up, you don't bow, you go into the furnace right away. Okay. Reading on verse 7. So at the time when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and in symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Verse 8. Therefore at the time, certain Chaldeans, magicians, I believe, came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the psaltery, and symphony, with all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the gold image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. Right there, they told a lie and a truth. No, they don't worship the king's gods. All right, that's true. They didn't bend down. That's true. But they lied about their service. They were good servants to the king. How many times have you guys run into folks like this, either at school or in your job? They're watching you. They're looking for anything that they can pin on you, and they turn you in. They rat you out. And, you know, these guys knew that the three boys weren't going to bend. So they were watching. You know, hundreds of thousands of people, only three standing. So where's Daniel? Where is Daniel? We know that he wasn't afraid. He'd already proved his mettle in the first two chapters, showing the kind of man that he was and the character. So it surely wasn't his choice. Some have speculated that the king sent him to Jerusalem to audit the city and take note of the fact that the temple had been torn apart, just to rub it in his nose. I don't tend to agree with that. I think the king deliberately did not invite him because the king didn't want to be confronted by Daniel and his God. He was thinking, Daniel has a clear line of communication with God, and I don't want him there. I don't want him ruining my event. So I think everybody was out of Babylon, and the king just naturally said, listen, you need to stay behind and run the city while we're all gone down in Dura. Now, why didn't they throw them into the furnace immediately? I think the king also knew that the three boys weren't going to bend, and he was going to use this to his advantage to parlay or capitalize on the situation. In front of all these thousands of people, he was going to sit down and be reasonable with the boys, talk logic, and help them come to a sound decision as to what they ought to do, and that would solidify his position with the rest of them, okay? And I think the king really believed that he could do that with them. So he doesn't throw them in the furnace. In fact, he gives them a second chance, and he comes across as their best buddy. Starting at verse 13, then Nebuchadnezzar in rage and fury gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, so they brought the men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Again, giving them the second chance. And it's important for us to recognize that here, this is what the world does to us as Christians. This is what Satan does to us as Christians. We know exactly what we should be doing. We've probably prayed about it. We've probably resolved. And then we get that second chance. We get the world putting its arms around us and talking logic to us. And some of the excuses that could have been made by them to them would have been, hey, the Lord put you in this great position. You're in the White House, okay? You have the confidences of the king. You can do so much. You've done so much. Why ruin it, all right? All you got to do is bend a little bit. In fact, Nebuchadnezzar, he'll probably let you just tilt your head a little bit. So why don't you do that, and don't lose sight of the fact that how many Jews were captured from Jerusalem? Thousands, probably. And how many Jews are at this function? Probably a lot. No, I believe a lot, all right? And we're standing there, or these three guys are standing there looking at everybody else doing it. So they stand alone, not only amongst the unsaved or the ungodly idolaters, they're standing alone amongst their own people. So the pressure to compromise was huge here. Moving on to verse 15. Now, if you are ready, this is the king talking to them. If you are ready, at the time you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, etc., and all kinds of music, you will fall down, and you fall down, and worship the image which I have made. Good. Huge second chance. Didn't throw you in the fire. Let me help you, okay? But if you do not worship, and I think, you know, the king was awfully close to sealing the deal there. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And the next sentence is very important. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Again, this is the personality, the character of the king. It's not him against these boys. It's not him against the Jews or Daniel. It never has been. It's him against God. So he's challenging God. And it reminds me of some of the Western movies that I'm so fond of, and I know you are, Todd. The old cowboy hero, nothing can shake that guy, all right? He just maintains an even keel, and the bad guys are doing all kind of bad things, and he's doing what he ought to be doing up until the bad guys insult his mama or his horse, okay? And I think that's kind of what the king did here. He made a mistake. He got in their face, and he challenged their God. And Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. That is sweet. Isn't that sweet? I love that. We have no need. Let me paraphrase what they were saying. O king, you should not have gone there. You should not have challenged our God. You should not have brought our God into this discussion. But you did. As a result, we don't have to answer you. Why? Because our God will answer you. I like that. Verse 17, if that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. There was no second guessing. There was no hesitation. They didn't form a committee. They knew exactly what their resolve was going to be. That is exactly what God expects of us. And it can't happen unless we see around the corner, we anticipate the right hook by Satan and what he's going to do, we pray about it, we pray about it together, we know what we're supposed to do because we are in the Word, and then we resolve, we purpose not to do it when we're faced with it. And we can always see it coming. That's the response that God expects from us. These guys knew that death was next, and they were fine with that, okay? I came across an anonymous quote recently. The quote is, "You can't conquer a free man. The most you can do is kill him." It's a good one. It's similar to Matthew 10:28. "And do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." Verse 19, "Then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." He thought he had them. He thought the deal, you know, everything was set. "I got these guys. I'm in front of all these thousands. They're all watching." And these guys just told me, "No way, stuff it." Okay. Verse 19, "He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace seven times more than it was usually heated. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them in the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their garments, and they were cast in the midst of the burning furnace." Again, they were royalty. They served the king. They were in the palace. They were wearing the finest outfits. And the Navy SEALs that worked for the king, they bound these guys' hands, feet, arms, legs, ankles, everything, and I think they threw him in head first. And the king was so mad that he didn't care that some of his Navy SEALs were killed in the process. Verse 22, "Therefore, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, the boys, fell down, bound in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, 'Did we not cast three men bound in the midst of the fire?'" Now the king, I think, like I said, I think he kept Daniel out of this because he didn't want to face the living God. Last time the living God merely spoke to him through Daniel. This time he gets to see him. I believe this is a Christophany. They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." "Look," he answered, "I see four men loose walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." Isn't it just like God to keep chasing after us? I know it was for me. And it's amazing that he's chasing after this king in this fashion. And of course, the king says some wonderful things, again, like he did 15 years prior, but it's just an intellectual affirmation that the Jewish God exists. It's not the true submission and contrite heart that God requires. That happens later. But Jesus never gives up on the king. Verse 26, "Then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, 'Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here.' Then the boys came from the midst of the fire, and the satraps, administrators, and governors, and the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of the fire was not on them. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, 'Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him, and they have frustrated the king's word.'" What an admission. They had frustrated the king's word. "And yielded their bodies, that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this." The guy still had his old habits, killing and maiming and burning. All right, then the kicker, verse 30, "Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon." How do you think those Chaldeans felt at that point, okay? And is Jim here? Here's a really bad pun. So if you want a sure-fired way to get a promotion, all right? Now, as I mentioned in the beginning, we're all going through tribulation. And I don't know how bad it's going to get here. I have no idea if the things going on overseas are going to come to our shores. It might. We need to be ready. We need to be praying about these things. A group of pastors just wrote to the Supreme Court, pastors and politicians, Christians, and they said to the Supreme Court, who is now considering the same-sex marriage issue, they said, if you come out on the wrong side, we will not obey the law. John or Jim Hagee of Texas signed it. Mike Huckabee signed it. Franklin Graham signed the letter. So the issue is, how do we live in a fallen world? Know what's going on. There's a military term that says stay frosty. Okay, that means stay alert. Be aware of your surroundings. For us, to be aware of what Satan is doing, what he's up to, and where he's going. Watching for that right hook, okay? Two, pray. These guys prayed in chapter 1 and 2, and they prayed in 3, and I believe they continue to pray for the king. Pray that God would empower you, give you the strength, the spirit to stand. Three, know your scripture. Stay in the word so you know what you should and shouldn't do, what God expects of us. Four, get rid of your excuses. Don't let it ever enter your head to have that little committee meeting and try to figure out what is logical and what the world thinks you ought to do. Five, ask God to give you the strength and courage to withstand and then stand. That's from Ephesians 6:13. And then finally, continue to pray for and love the people that persecute you, which is really, really hard to do. And again, I believe King Nebuchadnezzar ultimately got saved because these guys never gave up on him, kept praying for him.